So specifically today, we're going to be looking at how Christians engage with issues of nationalism and national identity. And the argument I'm going to make, based on the research I've done, is that Protestants demonstrate critical selectivity in embracing the tenets of official nationalism. What does that mean? Well, we will see shortly. And it's those who have pre-existing critical attitudes towards the values that characterise official nationalism who are more likely to become Protestants. And therefore, the growth of Protestantism amongst young urbanites could be seen as a symptom of the existence of moderate disaffection amongst this demographic group. And all this will be elaborated as we go on. So, I guess my research is really based in the theories of religion and nationalism that are doing the rounds, have been doing the rounds for the past 50 years. Clifford Geertz, the classical anthropologist, talked about the way that religion was a countervailing force to nationalism. It was a form of identity that was primordial, and it really detracted from the nation builders' project of forging new national identities. So this is Jawaharlal Nehru, founding father of India. He had a very secular vision of the Indian state that would not be party to any particular religious interests. So Hindus, Muslims and Christians and Buddhists could go their separate ways, but all would be equal when it came to the states. And that's recently been challenged by the BJP, as we've seen. But then we also have religious nationalism. Mark Jürgensmeyer talks about this, and an obvious example is the Iranian Revolution and the desire to fuse religious and national identities. But we also see some communities of religious people, such as the Amish, withdrawing somewhat from the politics and of the nation and forming their own communities, wishing really to keep themselves separate from the political realm. And of course, Huntington has famously argued that in the post-Cold War era, the world order will be defined by competing civilizational blocks defined by cultural and religious identities. So you have the West, the Islamic bloc, Africa, South America, the Slavic bloc, the Sinic bloc, the Buddhist bloc, the Hindu bloc, and all of these are kind of competing for power, and around their border regions we see conflicts. And Jose Casanova, the Spanish sociologist, would agree with him that in the post-Cold War era, religious identities have become important. But actually, rather than becoming cemented into territorial blocks, Casanova says that religion has become deterritorialized. And so Pentecostalism, which had its origins in the United States, has now become a truly global religion. I think these guys are in Malaysia, engaged in some very lively worship. So how have these different ways of interacting played out throughout Chinese history? Well, Protestantism first arrived in China in the 19th century, in the 1800s, and it really arrived on the back of Western imperialism. It's a particularly dark association, unfortunately. The Opium War meant that Britain was trying to force its way into China so that it could sell the opium that it was growing in India, and China's war on drugs at the time failed. This is the HMS Nemesis destroying the Qing Dynasty war junks, and Britain managed to extract all sorts of concessions from the Qing Dynasty, including protection for its missionaries. And so there's always been that association that actually Protestantism entered China with the gunboat. But that's not the only story. In the 1850s, a man by the name of Hong Xiu Quan challenged the Qing dynasty, and he himself was a Han. He has been seen by some, including, ironically, Mao Zedong, as a proto-nationalist, one who was fighting for the rights of the Chinese people's self-determination against the Manchu Qing dynasty, which were considered foreign at the time. He thought that he was Jesus' little brother. He got hold of a Christian tract and interpreted it in a, shall we say, creative fashion. And his ideal, he wanted to form this utopia called the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. And he gradually, he formed it over a period of 14 years, but gradually he was defeated, and even by that time, even the Protestant missionaries thought that he was a bit of a fruit loop, and it came to nothing except for the deaths of several tens of millions of people. And then the Boxers arose at the turn of the century as the anti-foreign sentiment was building up and dissatisfaction amongst local Chinese with the conditions that had been enforced on China by the foreign powers. The Boxer movement arose and it just went, it was an anti-foreign movement. It attacked Christians, it attacked missionaries. And 30,000 Chinese Christians were killed and 250 Western missionaries. And in return, there was an eight-nation army marched all the way to Beijing, destroyed the Summer Palace, and was involved in widespread looting and massacring, aided by the Christian missionaries. So there's a bit of victimhood and also villainy involved as well. And I like this cartoon. This is a French cartoon from the time that, well, I guess it speaks for itself. The missionary movement did have some positive impacts, however, and one of them was the growth of education. And missionary education in the late 19th century led to the emergence, it has been argued, of a nationalist movement in the early 20th century. We see people like Sun Yat-sen, Song Wai-ling, and later Chiang Kai-shek converting to Christianity, sometimes as a result of their education, and very much leading the drive to modernise China. So Sun Yat-sen was part of the revolution in 1911 that overthrew the Qing dynasty. Song Wai-ling, highly interesting and intelligent lady, educated at Wellesley College in the USA, and later married Chiang Kai-shek, who converted, some would say, in order to marry her, for political expediency. But nevertheless, he had a very firm belief in the righteousness of his cause. He saw Jesus as the leader of a national revolution, and he was very keen to defeat the Japanese and also the communists, which he failed to do, and then he fled to Taiwan in 1949. So, at the communist takeover, the opinions of Christians were very much divided. There were some, such as Ding Guangxun, who were very optimistic about the communist project. They saw it as a way of renewing China, and one to which Christians could and should contribute. So he was a member of the founding member of the Three Self-Patriotic Movement, which was China's official church under the communists. And he was staunchly opposed by others, such as Wang Mingdao. Wang Mingdao was a pastor of a very indigenized, conservative Protestant denomination, and he regarded those who cooperated with the communists as apostates. And he ended up in jail for 17 years because of his opposition to Ding and the Three Self Movement. And then in the Cultural Revolution, it was the high point of persecution against Christians, and you might just be able to see there. This Red Guard is smashing all the old bad things about China, including gramophone records, Buddhist idols, and we see here a crucifix. So the Cultural Revolution was a time when all religion was banned, but it was actually also a time when the state retreated from a lot of daily life, and it meant that actually in rural areas, Christian evangelists were free to proselytise in a way that enabled them, upon the ending of the Cultural Revolution, to emerge and to re-establish a church in rural areas and to preach the gospel amongst people who would not otherwise have heard it. So, that was then. This is now. China is changing rapidly since the 1970s. When Deng Xiaoping launched his economic reforms, China's economy has grown at an average of double-digit growth per year. And I'm just going to leave the background slide on. This is the district of Wudaoko in Beijing, looking over westwards to the fragrant hills. This was turnip farms in the 1990s, according to my old supervisor. And now, we have hotels, we have apartments, we have a technology park, which is part of Tsinghua University. And alongside economic changes, we also have social changes. We've have Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll, the latter of which we have a photo of here. This is the MIDI Festival, which is held just outside Beijing every year. And I think it would be fair enough to say that Chinese people have never been more free in their daily lives and certainly in their private lives. And alongside this comes a renewed international exposure. And here we see the website for Vista Village, the Chinese edition. More and more people are able to leave China, and more foreigners are able to go to China. There's a lot more exposure to foreign ideas, and a lot more exposure in the world to what Chinese people think, which we will get onto in a minute. But at the same time, there's growing inequality. China has just tipped over the point where more of its population are urban than rural, but still there are a great number of subsistence farmers. The Gini coefficient has increased, and we have people like this Fuardai on the right. Fuardai means second generation wealthy, the sons of those who made it rich in the first flush of economic growth, and they generate quite a resentful feeling amongst those who are trying to struggle their way up by their bootstraps. They feel like opportunities have been monopolised by this very privileged generation. And one of the reasons for that is because of corruption. And there's a perception that as China has developed, it's beginning to lose the values that once defined it, the values of thrift and kindness and goodness to others. And just one example in recent years, it was the general Gu Zhongshan who was in charge of the PLA, I think it was the logistics department, and he managed to sell a lot of property in Beijing for below market prices in return for kickbacks. And so when his compound was raided, they carried away four trucks full of loot, including a solid gold statue of Chairman Mao, which I think if Chairman Mao had known that, that would happen, he would be spinning in his... Well, he's actually pickled, so it wouldn't be his grave, it would be his formaldehyde. Now, economic growth also has brought environmental degradation. This is a photo out of the window of my flat in Beijing, and Beijing has become infamous for its pollution levels, which have made it unhealthy just to walk outside the door on some days. And so all these, this mixture of joy and pain... the problems of rapid economic growth and social change have led to a very lively societal debate. These people are the movers and shakers in just a few of the many movers and shakers in the public debate in China. If you haven't heard of these people, I suggest you look them up. They're as influential as the Amartya Sens, the Noam Chomskys, and certainly more influential than the Russell Brands of the Western world. Bo Xilai unfortunately fell from, well, depending on whose side you are, he fell from grace a few years back for his involvement with the murder of a Western businessman. But he was very much in favour of returning to the Maoist style of public planning and social justice. Yan Xuetong, he's more of a neocon. He's very much about increasing China's comprehensive national power, having a hawkish foreign policy. Eric Li and Huan Gang are, I guess, they've done a lot of apologetics work on behalf of the Chinese communist regime, saying that China needs a strong state because without it, it will collapse, and look what happened to the USSR, it wasn't a great outcome. Liu Xiaobo, you may have heard of him. He was more of a kind of liberal, democratically inclined intellectual. He founded the Charter 08 movement, which... was an online petition for constitutional government, and of course he was then jailed. But aside from radicals like him, there are liberals who work within the system, such as Wang Yang, who is a pro-free market former boss of Guangdong region, and he was very much in favour of a more liberal style of politics, a more marketised style of politics, and his imprint can be seen in the nature of the way that the province of Guangdong is run. And then we have Hu Shuli, investigative journalist. She's written some very interesting things for Caixin Media Group. And then Han Han, the kind of trendy blogger and racing car driver, amongst other things, who represents the new generation, the Baling Ho, as they're called, those born since the 1980s. Another feature of China in recent years has been the perceived increase in nationalism. And there's been a debate amongst theorists as to whether this is a bottom-up phenomenon or a top-down phenomenon. Certainly since 1994, as a way of restoring its legitimacy in the wake of the Tiananmen Square crisis, the government has been pushing something called patriotic education. Which makes sure that all kids are taught to love their country, to love the Communist Party, about how the Communists rescued China from the Japanese, etc., etc. And so, the key tenets of official nationalism, as I've just said, the primacy of national identity, the primacy of a strong CCP-led state, economic growth and social stability leading to national strength, the kind of zhonghe guoli, the comprehensive national power, territorial sovereignty, including over Taiwan, and more recently the South China Sea and the Diaoyu Islands. And there's also a victim narrative, which stresses, you know, the suffering that China has been through, the 100 years of shame at the hands of the West, first with the Opium War, and later the Japanese with the invasion that later became part of World War II. And there's also a stress on the link between personal morality and national strength. And this is often talked about in terms of the language of suju. Suju is a word which doesn't really translate very well into English, but it has kind of connotations of personal quality, refinement, education, even chastity. And so increasing the population suju has been a key drive of party policy in recent years. At the same time, we also have a religious revival, and that includes Christianity. One of the largest Christian revivals in history, China now has 50 million Protestants, according to the Pew Foundation. Christianity is legal. I always get asked, oh, if you're a Christian in China, don't you get shot? The answer's no. It's fine to be a Christian. The difficulty comes when it comes to places of worship, because some places of worship are registered, and they're legit, they're above board, they're fine, and others are unregistered, the churches that are known as house churches, but don't necessarily meet in houses, some of them meet in offices or other places. Generally, unregistered churches are in a kind of semi-legal grey area. They are generally tolerated as long as they don't get too big or too loud or too public. But sometimes we still do see periodic crackdowns. So this is a church in Wenzhou, a city in South China, which was demolished last Easter, ostensibly because it violated planning rules. But a lot of people, especially Christians in China, think that that was an excuse on the part of the Xi Jinping administration to launch a crackdown against churches. Incidentally, this is actually a registered church and not an unregistered church. So the registered church are not always free from these occasional crackdowns. So, on to the meat. My research. I carried out field work in 2011 and 2012 in Beijing, in the north, next to the Great Wall, and in Shenzhen, in the south, near Hong Kong. And I interviewed 100 people, 50 in Beijing, 50 in Shenzhen, 50 Protestants, and for comparative purposes, 50 of other or no religious affiliation. They were generally the winners of China's current economic and social policies. They were white-collar professionals, university graduates, and between the ages of 20 and 40. So the Qiling Ho, the Baling Ho, those born after 1970 and after 1980. And I recorded all my interviews, I transcribed them at great length into an Excel spreadsheet, and then, with the help of some friends, thank you Anne and Peter, and then I carried out a brief content analysis on the findings, comparing the attitudes and the opinions of the Protestants with the comparison group of their demographic peers who were not Protestants. So my aim was to find out What did Protestants think about the core tenets of official nationalism that we've just gone through? And were there any differences between Protestants and their non-Protestant demographic peers? And at this point I'm going to have a drink because my throat is quite dry. So, sorry?
Air pollution not.
Yeah. So what did I find? Well, Protestant Christians, firstly, the way that they think about China is not too dissimilar from their demographic peers. And we'll go into more detail about that later. But they consider national identity to be important. But it's not the ultimate thing. It's secondary to their Christian identity. They're more critical of China's current political arrangements. They're more positive about the idea of democracy. They show less concern with economic growth. And they're less hawkish when it comes to international and territorial issues. They show more concern about the moral state of Chinese society. That's going to get slightly complicated, as we will see. But those are the findings. So with regards to the party state's national narrative, relative to their demographic peers, I'm going to stand over here so that I can point to Carol Vorderman style, on the importance of national identity, similar with a few complications, which we'll get to. On the need for a strong CCP-led state, Protestants diverged further from the national narrative of the party state than did their demographic peers. The same for economic growth. Their demographic peers were much closer to official nationalism. And on international and territorial hawkishness, the non-Protestants were closer to the official party line. As for social morality, this was one of the areas where the Christians actually were closer to the kind of narrative that the party state is promoting than their demographic peers were. But again, this gets slightly complicated. All will be explained. So, on the question of national identity, I asked my respondents, what is China? Nice simple question. And what does it mean to be Chinese? And so they came up with similar definitions, whatever religion or lack of religion they belong to. Culture, tradition, Chinese people, geography, borders, land. There was no real disagreement about the discursive boundaries of China. And there was no real disagreement in terms of affection. There was similar affective terms used, such as motherland, 我的祖国, 生我养我的地方, the place that has birthed and nourished me, which I think is quite a nice little poetic phrase, and my hometown, or I love this country, I am a patriot. You get 爱国者. However, Protestants were more likely to articulate a sense of responsibility for their homeland. So this is what one of my respondents said. She says she's born in China, she really loves it, lots of problems, but we're going to try and work hard and work them out. And if I didn't love the place, I wouldn't be complaining about the problems because I wouldn't care. But there was also a sense that as Christians, Protestants' identity transcended national boundaries. And so here's one of my respondents saying that actually there's no real difference when it comes down to it between Chinese, Americans or Europeans. Neither Jew nor Greek, male or female, to quote Paul. And he's echoing this here. All are the same in Christ. When it came to the party state, we see a distinctive pattern emerging between Christians and their demographic peers. The way that I calculated this was, if someone, I would ask, say, what's your opinion of the local government? If someone mentioned a positive thing, they would get a point. If they mentioned a negative thing, they would get a minus point. And then I kind of averaged all the points over the different groups and came up with an index for each question, for each group. And so local government really depended on the area that they were in. Beijing people didn't like their local government, Shenzhen people did. And I think I can agree that just from my personal experience, Shenzhen is a very, very, very well-run city, and Beijing leaves a lot to be desired, it would be fair to say. But that really was irrespective of religious affiliation. However, when it came to the central institutions, so the central government, the political system, and the party, discrepancies did emerge, and it was the Christians who were a lot less happy with the party state. So this is a self-declared patriot, a patriotic Protestant, talking about his country, and saying that when he thinks about his country, the term, the kind of concept of China is separate from the concept of the Chinese government, and he's not very impressed by the latter. Again, this is a female respondent from Shenzhen, complaining about the fact that although constitutionally Chinese people have the right to elect, it's a bit of an empty promise because she hasn't really been able to elect any leaders in all of her 27 years. And just by way of contrast, this is one of my comparison group's opinion. He says, well, you know, there are problems with the political system, but generally it's okay, despite there being space to improve. And so I did ask respondents, should China's political system be changed? The options were basically yes, no, or not yet. And for the comparison group, the most popular answer was, well, yes, but not quite yet. So we see 50% of them agreed to that answer. Whereas for the Christian group, there was a clear majority in favour of change. And this is a difference that is replicated over both cities. And there was also a hope for a gradually more democracy among the Protestant respondents. They weren't, you know, radicals, they didn't want to overthrow the system immediately, but they were hoping for a gradual movement towards a more participatory system. And so this is one respondent from Beijing expressing her hopes for China, but saying that actually she's worried that the Chinese government is actually moving in the opposite direction. A further feature of Christians' interaction with the official national narrative was that they were far more sceptical of the primacy of economic issues. It was the non-Protestants who were more likely to mention economics and material gain as a source of pride or hope. And so this lady from Beijing happens to be in the banking sector, so she mentions the fact that China's economy is developing very fast, material conditions are better. You know, she says, when my parents were growing up, they were just grateful for food, but I have the choice that, you know, I get a whole menu of different items to choose from, and that's generally a good thing. Contrast this with a respondent from a Protestant respondent who said, well, everyone's thinking is just restricted to these things. People just want more. They want a flat, they want money, they want a better degree, but is this really going to make people happy? And do we really have future ideals? And so a kind of a wariness, a caution about a headlong rush into economic development. And similarly, when it comes to international and territorial issues, China's international image was mentioned less often by the Protestant respondents. So this is a respondent from Shenzhen talking about the way in which the government seems to be wanting to do all these projects to gain its international status, like getting someone to the moon, winning gold medals, making the world's tallest building, all these kind of toys of a powerful state. And later on in this interview, she complains about how they're actually reducing her own welfare benefits, and she feels like the cares of the needs and the cares of the common people are neglected in favour of these Mianzigongcheng, or face projects. And again, on international and territorial issues, when it comes to the USA, there's a very complex mixture of attitudes within the Protestant sample. So there's a feeling that the US political system is good, but US foreign policy is bad. You know, the US criticises China all the time. It bullies small countries like Iraq and Libya. And but they were less likely in articulating their criticisms of the USA to use the official language of hegemony, or Bachuan, to describe the USA. But they were also more likely to criticise the USA for its liberal attitudes towards homosexuality. They felt that democracy was good, but you could have too much of a good thing, and it led to all sorts of sexual immorality, drug taking, and it was very similar to the sort of rhetoric you hear from the American Christian right. And in fact, it was the only area, really, attitudes towards sexuality, was the only area in which Protestants were consistently more illiberal than their non-Protestant demographic peers. Now, on the issue of Japan and the horrible things that the Japanese army did in China, there's a great deal of social anger in China about visits to the Yasukuni Shrine by the current Prime Minister and worshipping the war dead that are buried there, changing textbooks to kind of destroy the record of what the Japanese army did in China. But there was a generally more forbearing attitude amongst the Protestants. So this lady talked about how the people who committed the atrocities are dead, how the new generation of Japanese should not really be held responsible for something that they didn't do, something that happened years before they were born. And this was not uncommon amongst the Protestants. And Protestants were also less bothered about the Taiwan issue, less likely to insist that it was part of China. And generally there was quite a positive attitude towards Taiwanese society and culture. So this respondent's talking about how she admires the democracy in Taiwan and the way that she perceives Taiwanese culture to mix Western and ancient Chinese customs as well, including Christianity. So one issue that the Protestants were more concerned about was that of social morality. Here we have a worker at a think tank in Beijing talking about how China has ditched its old beliefs but hasn't really got any new consensus, any new form of morality that can really inform people's decisions in the modern era of kind of urbanised economic growth. That money tends to be the order of the day without really any critical reflection about deeper issues. And this was a very, very common theme amongst the Christian respondents. In fact, amongst all respondents, but particularly the Christians. And indeed, the party state has also articulated this. This is Xi Jinping in a speech in August 2013 complaining about the party members being hollowed out ideologically, worshipping money, fame, enjoyment, not having any reverence in their hearts and not having any moral baseline. However, there are important differences between the ways in which the Protestants in my study regarded the moral questions facing China and the way that the party state thought about the moral questions. The Protestants in my study would sometimes blame the party state for China's moral problems, perceived moral crisis. So this respondent in Shenzhen is saying, well, if you're corrupt, you can't really preach morality on your population because you'll have no credibility. And so how do you solve the problem? Well, my Protestant respondents were very clear that they thought the only way to solve China's perceived moral crisis was a bottom-up renewal, a spiritual and social renewal caused by a Christian revival that they could bring about via preaching the gospel. And establishing a new moral consensus based on the Bible. This is what this respondent is talking about. Whereas for the party state, the solution is more ideological education, greater control over the internet to stop the immoral things from emerging in the first place, and a top-down corruption crackdown, which is recently come into play under the new Xi administration. So, to summarise, Protestants had no distinctive concept of the discursive boundaries of China. They saw national identity as important, but not ultimate. They were more critical of China's current political arrangements, more positive about the idea of democracy, less concerned with economic growth, less hawkish on international and territorial issues, and more concerned about the moral state of Chinese society, but in a way that was subtly different from the party state. And I have labelled this a critical national narrative, because on most of these issues, The Chinese Protestants were slightly more divergent from official nationalism than were their demographic peers. And this then raises the question, why? Is it the case that Protestants embrace a critical national narrative, or is it those who hold a critical national narrative embrace Protestantism? And I go into depth on this in my thesis, but time being what it is, I'll concentrate on the explanation that I find most convincing. And that is as follows. So a few of my respondents converted to Protestantism because they explicitly rejected China's social norms. So this respondent was a law student, and as a law student at a university in Beijing, she did an internship at the prosecutor's office, and as part of the internship she had to witness a session of lethal injections. So she saw three lethal injections. She said, "My worldview totally collapsed because I thought that, before I thought that you could use the law to punish the bad and reward the good, but this incident really shocked me and gave me doubts about what was right and wrong." And she eventually got talking to her professor at university, who was a pastor at a local house church, and she became a Christian through his teaching. But some people became Christians out of a more implicit rejection of social norms. So I asked people, why did you become a Christian? What attracted you to Christianity? And I got various answers, experience of God, some kind of supernatural experience, influenced by reading the Bible, trouble or general unhappiness in life. And then a lot of people talked about the ways in which they saw Christians being different from the rest of society, which may imply that they weren't that happy with what they saw in the rest of society, a more implicit idea of searching for something that they couldn't find elsewhere. And it's interesting that the majority of my respondents became Christians at university, which was, in all societies, is often the time of questioning established norms. So this is, and I apologise for the length of this quote, this is what one of my respondents says. After I arrived at university, suddenly all the questions that I had suppressed because I was too busy studying for the infamous college entrance exam, the Gaokao, they all sprung up and I started to ask these really deep questions, and I saw people rushing around me doing all sorts of things, but I didn't know what I really wanted. And one day she was in her dorm doing her homework, and two girls in the class above her came round and told her about Jesus, and she became a Christian. So, for people with a kind of questioning attitude, a kind of openness to exploring big questions, that are kind of maybe looking for answers outside those provided by the party state, then one response is to develop a set of values at odds with those that they'd previously learned. And it is these people who are most likely to become Christians. And this doesn't mean that they all will. But Protestantism can provide these people, according to their own, according to what they told me in their interviews, it can provide them with an alternative national narrative with which they can make sense of the world. A normative framework, a sense of moral agency, and a community of people in which these norms operate so that they don't feel like they're kind of going it alone as lone rangers, so to speak. And the Protestant project also gives them a chance to put right what they see wrong with Chinese society. It's a way of saying, well, look, you can actually do something about this via the spreading of the gospel. Having said that, causal directions are not mutually exclusive. So it might be the case that someone searching for a new kind of value system joins a church and then finds himself in a room full of people who have similar views, are on a similar search, are similarly dissatisfied, and then a form of kind of, I don't want to say groupthink, but certainly reinforcement occurs. So, contrary to what we see in the media of a kind of monolithic Orwellian state brainwashing a kind of compliant population, that's often one of the Western journalistic narratives that you see about Chinese society, My research shows that really the state discourse, the nationalism that they promote, has not been universally accepted. And it's the construction of national narrative has been fluid, it's been selective, it's been contested, and it's become pluralised as people have begun to question what they see. And the growth of Protestantism is a symptom of this. It may be one indication that the legitimation strategy of the party state has not fully satisfied this demographic group. Now, I only interviewed a small number of people, and it was a non-random sample, so further work is needed to see how big this demographic, how big this well of dissatisfaction is within this demographic group. We know that a lot of people actually are satisfied with the way things are and are hopeful for the future. But nevertheless, the fact that this exists within the group who are, in many ways are the winners of the current economic and social reforms should give pause to reflect what we're thinking about, whether the legitimation strategy has worked. And so sociologist Yan-Yun Shang talks about the rise of the individual in China, and this isn't really a threat to the party state. But the rise of the critical individual does raise demands that the CCP seems not yet to be meeting. And this does not mean that political change is imminent. It doesn't mean that Christians are all out there banging on the doors trying to have a change of government. But it does mean that there is a moderate sense of disaffection out there. And if the values expressed by my respondents are in any way representative of a trend in wider urban China, then we may be seeing a gradual value change. The post-Tiananmen deal, i.e., we will let you get rich if you don't question our right to govern you, we may see that beginning to unravel. And that parallels the 1960s value shift in Europe and North America, the shift from materialist values of a culture that really values stability and economic growth and national strength to their children, the baby boomers, who were more interested in the environment and peace and racial equality and these post-materialist concerns. This is a theory of a guy at Michigan called Ronald Engelhardt. It's contested, but it's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see whether this theory applies to China, but my research may hint that there's something in it. And so the Chinese Communist Party will need to develop a national narrative rooted in values other than political stability, economic growth, and international and territorial assertiveness if it wants to please and to appeal to this new demographic group. But so far, Xi Jinping does seem to be going for the economic growth route, the hawkish rhetoric, the greater political control. So we will see what happens there. Keep your eyes open. Maybe this is due to a generation gap, as I say. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, Xi Jinping is one of the younger members of the Politburo and he is a Wuling Hou. He was born in 1959, whereas the youngest of my respondents was born in 1989, 30 years after him. So I think future research on China should focus on intergenerational politics. I think that'll be a very valuable endeavour. So, here is one lady who is perfectly satisfied with her life in Beijing. Thank you very much. And here is some homework, should you wish. I've been experimenting with QR codes. I hope that they don't lead you to anything dodgy, but try them out. I'm trying to drag myself up into the 21st century, and I'm also on Twitter. So there you go.
Thank you, Phil.